Today is June 25th, 2015, and this is a phone conversation with Roger Nice and Tom Martin. Roger, could you spell your last name for me, please?
Sure. Last name is N as in Nicholas, E-I, S as in Sam, E, Sam, pronounced Nicis.
Nicis, thank you. N-E-I-S-E-S-S.
That's correct.
Great. How old are you?
65 this year.
Okay, where were you born?
I was born in Fullerton, California. It's in North Orange County, right next to Anaheim and Disneyland and all that.
Okay. And who was your grandfather?
My grandfather was, we call him Rod Sanderson. I think that's how he's generally referred to in river history. I know in the guidebook it says that. His actual first name was Raleigh.
Okay. And what do you remember about Rod as a young man or as a kid? What are your memories about him?
Right. Well, I just remember him as being, for me, he was the prototype grandfather. He was, a great big guy, and he always had a great big laugh, and was always willing to tell a story. He loved to go fishing, and probably as much as anything, he loved the Colorado River. I think he started running back 47, 48, somewhere in there, and picked up some boats from Doc Marston that he used every year as kind of like family vacation river running boat.
Uh-huh.
And he would bring along on those trips a 16-millimeter movie camera and take movies of the trips as they went down. Always plus stage trips, about the only time they could use the boat that he had. And then he would bring them over to Fullerton to, visit with his daughter, his oldest daughter, who was my mom. And I would sit there underneath the card table where he had the projector running and just not even want to move while he was running those incredible pictures of those three 19-foot aluminum hull boats with the, he had twin 35-47 rigs on them. And these trips would generally take about 10 days, and we'd sit there and look at these movies for about an hour or so. And I was just total rapt attention on that particular place. And he was just, he was incredibly in love with the Grand Canyon and his opportunity to be a part of it in the way that he was.
Neat. Could you tell me the name of your mom?
My mom's name is Helen.
Helen.
Yeah, and because her last maiden name was Sanderson, a lot of people just call her Sandy. And interestingly enough, that was a very common nickname for my grandfather as well.
Well, that's fun.
Yeah, and for us kids, he was just Gamp, because the oldest grandchild in the family wasn't staying as ours. You know how that works.
Yep.
And so my grandparents were Gamp and Ganny, and Rod was Gamp. And that's how I remember him the most. He was Gamp, and he brought the movies, and it was just incredible to sit there and watch those every single year from, like I said, from the time I was five until, I don't know, he made his last trip. I'm wanting to say started building the dam in 56. I think they made a trip in 56. I think they made a trip in 57, actually. 58, there may have been a trip. But they ran several of them, all of the boys, Larry, Jerry, Bud, and Bill, with the exception of my Uncle Dick. The other four boys all learned how to run river from Gamp on those trips, using those boats.
So Roger, the people you mentioned, Larry, and Jerry and Bud and Bill, were these all Rod's sons?
They were.
Okay.
And my grandmother's name was Lois.
Okay.
So Rod and Lois had a rather large family, 8 kids.
Okay.
My mother, Helen, was the oldest, followed in order by Larry, and then or Bud, and then Larry, and then Jerry, Bill, and Dick. And then the last two kids were both girls, Karen and then Judy.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Of those 8 kids, my mom, Larry, and Karen survived to this day. Larry is in Prescott Valley. My mom is still in Fullerton, California, in the house I grew up in. She and her husband have been married to my dad, Kendall. They have been married a long time.
Cool.
I'm sorry.
No worries.
47. So, and they're both still very active in their church and
good
things. My Aunt Karen lives in Page, so that's where the siblings are scattered around to at this point.
Okay. Where did those films go, those 16-millimeter films?
You know, my cousin Kevin, as far as I know, still has them. So they're out there. And I think they have been dubbed onto video and disc. I think at this point in time, if that is something that you would like me to work on getting you,
I'd love to see those.
You know, I would be happy to talk to Kevin and see if he has them. Or I used to have an 8 millimeter, or not an 8 millimeter. A VHS tape, Tom, that goes wrong, and I have the meaning to look for it, and I will.
That'd be great. I mean, we can get that digitized as well. But
right.
Either way, that'd be great stuff. I know that the museum collection at Grand Canyon National Park would be very interested in that stuff.
Yeah, I think Jerry had them put onto tape, and that's where I got a copy of it. However, if you've never seen them. They are a definitive treat to watch.
I'd love to see them.
If there's a way that I can make that happen for you, I will. Always looking for a good reason to go to Flag. So,
and even the 16-millimeter original films, that'll be the best if those are still
okay.
Around. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that Kevin has those. You know, he still lives up the page. Do you know Kevin?
I don't. No. Well, I've heard of him, but I don't know him. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, Hoff is still up there. Jerry passed away a couple months ago. And Kevin still has the old River Warehouse and shop building there. He does some stuff with it during the summer when there's a few more tourists in town.
Uh-huh.
I think it's called Into the Grand.
Okay.
Is what renamed it, and he does. He's got quite a bit of river history and lore and mementos kind of scattered around through the warehouse there as kind of a museum.
Nice.
So it's kind of an interesting walkthrough. And next time you get up there, you ought to stop in and check it out and introduce yourself. And Kevin's just like his dad. He likes to talk and tell stories and show people around.
Nice. Okay, so you're a young kid, you're under the table, you're watching these mesmerizing films from GAMP, and then what happens?
Well, my mom and dad, best way to get into this. Jerry and Larry and Bill were all working for the Bureau of Reclamation on the Grand Canyon Dam project at one time or another. Larry was a high scaler, actually set the initial charge that President Eisenhower detonated by remote from Washington, D.C.
So okay, yep.
I guess there's some family history there as well. Jerry was a ranger, part of the Bureau of Reclamation Police Force. And I think my Uncle Bill worked at the water treatment plant that served the construction camp that later became known as Page.
Okay.
So there was family history not only tied to the river, but also to the dam, Lake Powell, and the city of Page in a large measure. Jerry and Larry, as they were Bureau employees, were asked by the commissioner of Bureau of Reclamation to put together a trip for Stuart Udall when he was Secretary of the Interior. I believe this trip was in 60, I'm wanting to say 65 or 66. I failed a little bit on that date, but it would be easily researched.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, they put together a couple of rafts that they picked up from either Ted Hatch or John Cross, one of the two, and just kind of a standard double 33 setup, you know, with a motor in the middle.
Yep.
Much like Georgie was running at the time.
Right.
And took Stuart Udall down. He wanted to see the canyon from the bottom up because there was such a heightened amount of controversy in terms of placing another dam in the canyon. He wanted to firsthand look at it. And so they took him down, and because of that trip, they were subsequently asked to by some other people if they were still doing trips and would they, you know, want to do them commercially. And, you know, little beginnings. By 1967, they had a full schedule of trips going down, you know, probably six trips or so. For them, that was a full schedule because they were both full-time employees of the Bureau of Reclamation still. So they would do these on whatever vacation and sick time they had put together at the time. In 1967, that expanded to about 12 trips. And by 1968, I was getting ready to graduate from high school. My parents had been on a trip in the summer before in 67 with Jerry and Larry. And they decided that, well, maybe for graduation, Roger would want to take the trip.
Hmm, okay.
And so they had it all set up. I was graduating from high school. I was supposed to be on the river 3 days later. And so I flew into Phoenix. And things, like I said, were moving along pretty good for Sanderson Brothers River Expeditions by then. I think the summer had grown from 12 trips to 24 trips. And they had called prior to June, about February, and asked me if I would want to stay the whole summer and do about three trips. And, of course, the answer was yes. So I made my way to Phoenix on an airplane, and my grandmother put me on a pickup truck with some guys that had fabricated some raft units for the boats that Jerry and Larry were designing. And off we went up to Page.
How old were you then?
I was 18.
Okay.
And 3 days out of high school. And almost never looked back from that point on. Like I said, I was on the river 3 days later. And it's hard for me to remember a lot of the details of that first trip. I'm sure it's the same for you. You're just trying to absorb so much at one time. It's like a kid at the mall. You just don't know where to look next, you know?
Yeah.
And I just absolutely felt a very strong affinity for where I was. And when I was on a boat running as a swamper with a guy I didn't really know that well. I mean, he was just, at that point in time, Jerry and Larry were kind of hard-pressed to find people people that had a lot of river experience that could, that would be willing to run trips. And so there might be guest pilots, I guess you would say, dropping in and out, making trips for Jerry and Larry all summer long while they were in the midst of trying to train the people that live there in town to become their staff, their mm-hmm. pilots.
Uh-huh.
And back then, the general rule of thumb was, if you make one trip as a swamper, you can make your next trip as a boatman. And by your fifth trip, we expect you to be a lead.
All right, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. One trip as a swamper, next trip you're driving. And by the sixth trip, you're the trip leader.
Yeah, that's kind of what they were going for, because they were getting so much business, you know, they just couldn't they couldn't find enough staff. So we were in the heavy training mode. From the time we hit Lee's Ferry to rig out the boat. And I say that laughingly, because the Park Service still has some rules and regulations involving whether or not you were a minor and whether or not you were over 21.
So right.
That had to be paid attention to. Actually, I didn't get a lead until I was 21. That was 3 years later. But we ran a different kind of trip than a lot of the other outfitters, and that was Jerry's business to some degree. He was a great businessman. He knew, or at least he almost had a natural instinct for how he wanted that trip and that business to move forward.
How was that? What made him different? What was he looking for? What did he do differently?
Jerry wanted, and this was very Jerry, but Jerry wanted to have the Cadillac trip out there. He wanted his people to know that all they had to do was pack a duffel bag and make it to Page, and everything else was going to be provided for him. His wet bag, his ammo can, all that stuff. He just has to, his sleeping bag, as far as that goes. I mean, we furnished sleeping bags throughout the entire history of Sanderson River Expeditions for our passengers. He just wanted them to literally get to Page and go on vacation and not have to worry about a whole bunch of details about a trip process that they knew really very little about. He wanted to handle all that for them. He wanted them to enjoy a first-class menu. And that's why he included, you know, steaks and ice cream and things like that on his river menu. And that was another aspect of, you know, our training. We had to learn how to be good cooks, as all bowmen had to be.
Uh-huh.
And he also wanted us, you know, to be entertainers. And because that's the way he enjoyed the trip. He liked to tell stories and fill in the history with, you know, anecdotes where he had them. And he had some history, you know, just because of the early trips that he had been on as a young man, learning how to run boats with his father. So there was a great deal of Rod and Jerry and Larry in all of the training that we did as pilots, in terms of how he wanted us to not only comport ourselves, but how he wanted us to interact with the people that came on our trip. He genuinely wanted them to have a resort experience on an expedition.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It was a real fun thing to try and get your hands around as a young pilot, as a young employee, to try and catch all of those different angles that Jerry and Larry were shooting for in terms of the character of their trips.
And what do you remember about those early, early trips? I mean, we're talking 1968 here.
Yeah. I remember running into people like Georgie White and going, oh my gosh, I'm actually sitting here listening to Georgie White tell a story. I can't even believe this is happening to me.
Cool.
And how much, how little regulation there was. I mean, at the time, it was, there was no such thing as a user day. There was no such thing as a porta potty. There was no such thing as carry out your trash. You know, you were supposed to take your cans and put a lot of holes in them and let their rocks on the bottom of the river grind them up. I mean, it was all really very campish. And really in 68 and 69, the visitation numbers weren't what we began to see in 70 and 71. There was an explosion there, it seemed to me, between 69 and 70 in terms of, you know, the popularity of the trip in general.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that anyone could really see that explosion coming. It just happened.
Hmm.
And I think that for all of us that were part of the, that were really stewards of the canyon, the boatmen, I think it surprised all of us to a large degree. And it helped us to eventually get a better grasp on how much we needed to pay attention to how we took care of the place.
Okay. And what else? So you met Georgie, and there was a huge explosion of river growth there. Y'all sort of became then stewards of the resource. What other stories do you remember about those late 60s, early 70s trips?
Oh, I think for the most part, I remember there being a lot less fluctuation in the river level. I think those were obviously wetter years for the drainage system. I don't ever remember running on anything less than, you know, 25,000 or so.
Okay.
It was just almost like a constant flow. And then as we got into years like 72, when they were impounding quite a bit of water and it was beginning to encroach a little on Rainbow Bridge up on Lake Powell, there was a lot of controversy there about the flows and you know, that you need to get more water into the canyon so that it doesn't harm the bridge. And so there was this constant, and it would move from court to court, as I remember. And one court would say, no, it's okay. And the next one up would say, no, you can't do that. And we're going to overturn. And it's just a lot of confusion as to what to do with the water that was coming into the drainage system. And so all of a sudden there was low water. And as pilots that you know hadn't really seen much under 20,000 or 25,000, all of a sudden there being 7,000 was kind of startling. So I remember we had to kind of rethink how we were operating our boats. Were we doing it by road? Oh, this rapid, you do this and you do that, or did you have to read the water a little bit more? And so I think some of the techniques of river running that I from that time forward, really tried to impress upon the swampers that I trained was that you cannot memorize how to run a given rapid. You have to be able to understand where the water is moving in the river and then use that to frame how you operated your boat.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed for me, as much as anything, how I trained my successors. And I think it was a good thing to be exposed to that, and I still think it is. I think you reach a point in your career. I ran almost 14 years, and I think you reach a point where you understand that the river is way bigger than you are.
Uh-huh.
You're simply kind of passing through, you know, a moment in time, and the river keeps on moving. You're kind of just there for a little bit. You have to adapt to what the canyon gives you, as opposed to trying to constantly force what you want the canyon to be onto it. It just doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a young boatman, you have a tendency to live in the latter perspective. And I think as you age in your boatman years, you begin to see that the former is really more true. I can't remember how many times I would sit on the back of the boat in the late evening and just watch the water go by and think, you know, this river is going to do the same thing day after day, year after year. It's going to be here long after we're gone, and it's going to clean up everything and all the damage that we did along the way. And it'll go on. It's been doing this for millions of years.
Uh-huh.
We're just here for a blink. Anyway, the early years were probably the more interesting years in a lot of respects, because we grew up with the Park Service in terms of how they decided they needed to start managing it. After that explosion, that visitation explosion that we saw in the early 70s, we began to help the Park Service incorporate all of those visitation regulations that were important to, you know, the stewardship aspect of what we as boatmen needed to keep in mind. I think when I look back on it, sometimes I say, you know, the early years were a lot of fun just because it was wild. It was like the Wild West, right?
Uh-huh.
And the later years were a lot more structured, a lot more regulated. And sometimes I look at those and go, well, you know, it's what we got to do to, you know, it's the right thing to do. But those early years, they sure were fun. So, you know, there's kind of some mixed emotion there.
Yeah.
But I had the opportunity to help train Tom Dort when he was, you know, one of the first two river rangers that was going to start taking trips and stuff to the Park Service on a regular basis with their own rig.
Okay.
And Tom always had an interesting perspective on it as well. And I remember his first trip was with me and Dave Bledsoe.
Okay.
And it was being difficult for him to grasp what it was his new job was going to be. And he had never really been down on the river. And now he was learning how to run a boat, because the boats that he was going to run were very similar to the S rigs that Jerry and Larry were running at the time.
Yep.
Eventually, the Park Service sort of incorporated a design that Ron Smith was using over at Grand Canyon.
That's right.
And that worked. It just worked better for what they needed to do. But it was still essentially, you know, a single baloney with two outriggers. So Tom was learning how to run it, and just being constantly a slapjaw about the immensity of and scope of his job to be.
Hmm.
He came away from that first trip with a very different perspective. It wasn't just about throwing a bunch of regs and bureaucratic legalese onto all of the other boatmen and outfitters that were working in the canyon. I think he appreciated his job from the perspective of not only being a boatman, but also being a ranger. And there was two different, there was something that he had to sort of weld together there, come together in the middle and help create the River Ranger Force, you know, as it exists today. I think, you know, it's done a little differently now,
Roger, how do you spell Tom's last name?
D-O-E-R.
And did his father work for the Park Service?
I don't know if his father did. Tom was working for the Park Service as a ranger at South Rim at the time.
Okay.
And he just, you know, this the river ranger position came up. There was another guy that was training with him on the same trip. I can't remember his name. I remember Tom very well. I think Tom made two trips, training trips with Sanderson. And he also made some trips with the other outfitters. I can't remember. It could have been Ron Smith over at GP. I can't remember. But anyway.
Okay. I was just curious about that. Roger, when was your last river trip through Grand Canyon?
Well, I worked for Jerry at Sanderson until through the 1980 season. One of my last river trips was actually taking then Governor Babbitt down on a river trip. That was kind of interesting. I left Sanderson's in 80. I had just gotten married. My wife, Kathy, and I got married in 79. And I decided that I probably ought to try spending some time learning a real job.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to do construction, worked a big construction job over here in the White Mountains. They were building Springerville Generating Station Units 1 and 2
uh-huh.
at the time, and I went to work at the concrete batch plant there. It was a subcontractor handling the concrete production.
Okay.
And eventually, I ended up being the superintendent at that plant. I was there for about 12 years. We made our way back to Page in 95, and I went to work for Aramark out at Lake Powell at their boat rental operation. And when I got back there, at the time, I was sitting on 96 trips. I had the most trips of any Sanderson pilot, but of course Sanderson no longer existed. Jerry sold the company to Del Webb in 1983. Actually, Del Webb bought Fort Lee Company and Sanderson River Expeditions at the same time, and then combined them into what is now Wilderness River Expeditions.
Right.
So, I was sitting on 96 trips when we moved back, and I was able to make a trip with Diamond in 96, and then I made two subsequent trips with Wilderness River Expeditions in 97 and 98. So now I'm stuck on 99.
Okay. So you're pretty close here.
We're going to have to do something about that at some point.
I think you are. Well, so then my next question is from 68 to 98, 20 years of perspective from your first trip to your last trip now, and now you're ready to go boating again. 2018's coming up, I'm just saying. What were there any changes that you saw in the river environment from 68 to 98?
Well, I think, and I alluded to this earlier, I think the biggest change, say from 68 through 71, was we knew that the river fluctuated every night because every once in a while, you know, we'd have to push our boats into the river in the morning, right?
Right.
Or we'd have to get up and retie them in the middle of the night, whichever the case might be, depending on where we were. But beginning in, from 72 through, actually through probably 78 or so, we dealt with what seemed to be a lot more fluctuation. I think it's probably just more of a, that was probably more just a result of, you know, combined wet years, dry years, power demand, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe that there was as much pressure on the Bureau or the Park Service to look at the habitat down there that in the same way that they do now. And that's why we have the two floods that they do every year.
Right.
To try and restore some of that. And, you know, if that is working, that's probably a good thing. It's nothing like the floods that used to come through. You know, when my grandfather was running his trips down through there, they would generally run on 128,000, 135,000, I think was the most they ever ran on. That was in 57, if I'm not mistaken. And the film from that trip is incredible. It makes Lava Falls look like a genuine rapid as opposed to, you know, more of a cataract that, you know, we ran on at, you know, you get below 20,000, lava is challenging, of course, but there's no real huge water in it.
Right.
And when you see it at 157,000, that hole, the ledge hole is just mind-boggling. And my grandfather's boats, like I said, they were only 19-foot aluminum boats. And I guess the saving grace in most cases is, you know, water flow does two things for a rapid. It either washes it out or makes it difficult to run. And in between, there's some fun stages to work with, but high water and low water is one extreme or the other. It's either there and it's great big and you can got lots of room to drive around in it, or in low water, you have to be pretty specific.
Right.
And like I said, in 72, when we were beginning to learn how to run on flows that were less than 12,000 or even 15,000 is more than norm, it was challenging. So it created some differences in how we camped. It created some changes in how we trained our staff. When I look at the trips that I made, most recently, the last three trips that I made, I can see the huge shift in how you deal with, your campsite, how you monitor your campsite. You know, there wasn't that much more regulation moved in, but I think some of the regulation had been honed a little bit. And in some cases, it may have been overkill. But again, I think as a practicing boatman, you have to realize you have a certain amount of stewardship obligation to the resource that you're utilizing. So,
right.
Whether it's good or bad, time will measure that.
Uh-huh.
And long after we're gone, someone may have the opportunity to look at 100 years of data and see whether or not it did that much. I don't know.
Yeah. Roger, go ahead.
I think that in general, the growth of regulation helped us to kind of hone in on how we needed to take care of the environment that we use. You know, it kind of changed, again, the perspective from, you know, being a young teenager with an exciting job. It kind of changed all of us to a little bit more thoughtful and perspective-driven boatmen by the time we finished our careers. And I think you can ask any of the boatmen, any of the elder boatmen,
uh-huh,
and probably tell you much the same thing.
Nice. Yeah, you mentioned that the Babbitt trip that you took down toward the end of your river career in the late 70s there was interesting. What was interesting about that trip?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about Bruce Babbitt was that while he was trained as a lawyer, he was also trained as a geologist. And whether or not a lot of people know that, I don't know. But on that particular trip, I had Bruce Babbitt, and I also had Dr. Robert Euler on the trip.
Ah.
And Bob Euler is probably, in my opinion anyway, the foremost authority on Grand Canyon anthropology and archaeology. So, and I had met him, actually, on my second trip down the river. He was doing a excavation there at Stan's Cave.
Right.
And my Uncle Larry knew Bob because he had also participated in some of my grandfather's trips.
Okay.
So he was, in a sense, a family friend, and I had the chance to meet him on my second trip, and it got a good tour of his work there at Stanton's Cave and what he was doing in there. And again, kind of a behind-the-scenes trip, and that was fun.
That was in 1968.
That was in 68, yeah.
Right.
That was one of those insider things that I got to do because of my relationship with the historical river family that knew the canyon. So, but Bob was on that trip. Listening to Bob and Bruce Babbitt talk about the anthropology, geology, and archaeology of the Grand Canyon, just sitting there on the boat talking, was fascinating for two people. Well, Bob's been in the canyon, in and out of the canyon, for most of his adult life, but Bruce wasn't exactly shy about sharing his knowledge either.
Nice.
It was interesting to see Bruce Babbitt in that light, as opposed to how we generally saw him, you know, as governor. It was just interesting.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. You also mentioned that you'd met Georgie, so I'm going to kind of think about other sort of river folks. Did you get a chance to meet Marston when he was on the GCE trips in the 70s before he died in 79?
I met him. He didn't know who I was other than the fact that he knew my grandfather.
Okay.
It was interesting to shake hands with a legend. He had quite a crowd around him, and I barely had time to simply introduce myself and tell him who I was and just small talk for 5 minutes.
Where did you meet him?
I believe I ran into him at could have been parked at Havasu, but I'm thinking it was further upstream than that. You know, it could have been in Marble Canyon.
So this was when he was on one of the GCE historic trips and you boated on by or vice versa. They
right,
boated
yeah.
past you guys. Okay, neat.
Yeah, we just sort of ran into each other. I mean, you know how that works as boatmen. You end up stopping at a lot of the same places. And one of the guys mentioned, you know, so-and-so was on our trip. And I said, no, but I've got to go meet him. So we did. But, it was interesting doing that. It was always interesting for me to listen to my Uncle Larry, and I made probably a half a dozen trips with Larry. Listen to Larry talk about the Marble Canyon dam site and all the work that went on there, because my grandfather was the head surveyor for the Bureau of Reclamation in that period of time, in the mid-40s there, as they were looking for the eventual dam site that they were going to, where they were going to construct.
Right.
And so, as a family, we had some inside stories about that were always interesting. And I don't know if you know this, Jerry has a collection of glass slides that my grandfather took when he was working there at Marble Canyon. And I would be surprised if Kevin still didn't have those as well.
Can you check?
That would be an interesting piece of information probably for you to look at sometime.
Yeah, because those can be scanned. That material can go digital. That'd be great to see.
I will try and get a hold of Kevin. Today is actually his birthday, so I need to send him some well wishes anyway.
Okay.
And I'll try and remember to ask him about that.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Some of those stories were good. My grandfather had a camp at the Royal Arch Creek, just downstream from the dam site where they were doing the work. And they were also the responsible party for hauling Bert Loper's boat up and tying it off.
Okay.
So whenever in those early years, and I remember when I first started running, the whole boat was there.
Right.
not anymore.
No.
And by the time that visitation explosion sort of wound down a little bit with the user day regulation, a lot of it had disappeared. But in those early couple of years that I ran, we would stop at the boat. We would go take people up and we'd look at Loper's boat, and then we would walk on downstream past that up into Royal Arch Creek where my grandfather's survey camp was.
Was that also called Burt's Canyon?
Yeah, it could have been. I mean, it was canyon right there, so it was kind of between the boat and the Royal Arches.
Right, you know? That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so
there were some tables in there.
My grandfather's survey table was still sitting in there.
Okay.
And it was, for me, it was an interesting few minutes to spend because you could sit there and see him and his guys sitting around and doing. It was a memory thing for me.
Nice.
I think the park's done a pretty good job of getting rid of a lot of old history down there. Some of it was kind of fun to have, but something like that was really more a piece of family history as much as anything.
That's right.
So for it to go away, you know, that's probably okay. But there were other things like that. I mean, I remember one of the old jet boats still being stuck down there below Grapevine, you know, before they hauled it out. I remember a lot of that stuff. It just doesn't exist down there anymore. I think that would probably fall into that answer of what has changed the most in the last 30 years that I started versus the beginning to the end of that span of time. A lot of that old history, the Park Service just sort of went in, cleaned up, and removed from there. And there can be some good thoughts to doing that. Nothing wrong with that, I guess.
Yeah. You mentioned that Jerry sold the company out to Del Webb in 83. Do you know why he did that?
I think that, I don't know, you know, his reasons were his own. I'm sure they offered him a lot of money.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe that was some of it. But he's been in it for so long, and maybe he was just ready to sit back and be done with it. I don't know. He still enjoyed the canyon and being in the canyon. But maybe he was just tired of running the business. So.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say. Like I said, his reasons were his own.
Okay.
Whatever they may be.
Fair enough. Yep. Okay.
I will share with you another funny story about the Marble Canyon survey crew.
Please.
And I've been thinking about this. You know how they had to move stuff in and out of there on their cableway.
Well, so back up a minute. Now, it seems like there were two exploratory attempts in that area. One was in 4850, and the other one was in 6264.
That was a revisit. We're talking about the 47, 48 period of time.
Thank you.
There.
Okay, yes. The tramway. Got it.
Yeah, the tramway. That was also the primary way to get people in and out as far as the staff was concerned as well. And as the story goes, according to Uncle Larry, they had hired a camp cook, and he came out to the head of the tramway site there, out of Cameron, and looked down in there and looked at the bucket that he was supposed to write down in. He said, "No, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do this." And he said, I changed my mind. And my grandfather really needed that cook down there. So he said, "Okay, well, you know, I'll take you back into Flag, and we'll get you on the next train out." And he'd come in by train. He was going to go out by train. And you and I both know. I mean, I went to college there in Flag and rode the train myself. So you leave in the evening, you get in the morning. So he had gotten in the morning. My grandfather drove in the Flag, picked him up, take him back out. And the guy shook his head, said, "No, I'm not going to do this." So Dan said, "All right, I'll run you back to Flag, and we'll get you some dinner, and you can leave on the train tonight." And the guy was fine with that. So he took him in and got him some dinner and more than one or two or three beers, I'm sure. And by the time dinner was done, the guy was pretty close to lights out. So Dan took him back out to the tramway, stuck him in the bucket, and sent him down to the river. He woke up in the morning and didn't have a clue what happened, except he was at the bottom of the canyon, not up on top. So that was how Gamp got his, made sure he had his camp cook. And I'm sure he did more than cook, but that was how it got him down there. As Larry liked to tell that story, that was always a fun one for him to tell. That really sort of started everything for Sanderson. Gamp working down there as the head surveyor and meeting Doc Marston. I mean, it all started there. So that whole little piece of orientation and historical storytelling that we would do with the folks, you know, once we got to that point in the canyon, all the way through the little hike up into Royal Arch Creek, was always kind of a fun, special little part of the trip for me. I enjoyed that.
Fun. Yeah, because it was those stories that I remembered from the trip we did in 1971 when I wrote about Multy Fulmer and his river running in 1955 through 1959. Those stories then came to life. So that was a lot of fun because you guys certainly talked about those stories. They meant nothing to me until much later. And then I looked back in rearview mirror and said, "I remember those guys talking about those stories."
Yeah, those early years really helped me to try and focus in on what kind of information I wanted to, you know, give to my people as they made their journey through the canyon. I wanted them to leave the trip with a feeling that they'd really experienced not only Grand Canyon, and, you know, we would talk about geology and how perhaps the canyon came to be. But also, I wanted them to have a feeling that they met some of these other people, that they, you know, met the people that worked on the Marble Canyon Dam side of things, that they understood who people like Georgie White, Doc Marston were, you know, how, and John Croft, and, you know, Ted and Don Hatch, you know, people that really had a lot to do with establishing some of history of river running in the Grand Canyon.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was important for them to know these people somehow. So these stories that I would glean from people like Larry or Jerry or Georgie or whoever it might be, those were the ones I wanted to pass along to them at some point in time. And you know, when you're just floating along down there, you're not trying to make a whole bunch of miles or anything in a given day, it's easy enough to just step away from the back of the boat and walk up there and talk to them about it. And so it made the trip, in my opinion, a little bit more of a personal experience. And I thought that was important. Grand Canyon, to me, is always and will always be, you know, a very special place. It's overpowering to some degree when you look at it from up above, and it's more personal when you're sitting on the boat down on the water. So there's kind of two sides to the Grand Canyon. And it was always important for me to try and make that trip a very special trip for the people, because it is a special place.
Yes. Nice. Excellent. Well, on that note, maybe we should wrap this up at this point. I want to ask you one more question. If somebody were to find this recording 50 years from now, is there anything else you'd like to mention to them?
Well, I think that we always, at Sanderson, and they still do it with Wilderness, we always had kind of a special little ceremony on the last side on the river. I'm sure that most river runners, most of the commercial people have some kind of a special thing they did on the last night. For us, we had these real cute little rat pins that June Sanderson had helped design and create. And we would give all the passengers that were leaving the next morning one of these little rat pins. And it was nice, in my opinion, that we could, you know, confer on them the title of river rat in a, you know, a very physical way, giving them that little piece of jewelry. I still have my first one.
Mm-hmm.
But also, to me, it was important for them to take home with them an understanding for how important it was to not only just take care of the Grand Canyon in the time that we're there. I mean, every morning it was, let's police the camp, let's pick up the trash, let's make sure that we're not leaving anything that we don't want the next group that might come in and use this camp to find. You know, we wanted to try and encourage them to understand that keeping, taking care of the environment that they visited or even lived in, whether it was a city park, whatever it could be, whether it was your home in your backyard, but keep it clean. Take care of the environment that you're a part of.
Nice.
And so I was always trying to kind of push that stewardship aspect that I had sort of adopted onto them. And I figure every group of 30 people that I sent out, if I could send out 30 stewards that were willing to, you know, adopt the same type of philosophy about the environment that they were living in, and sometimes they brought kids, and those kids would grow up, maybe, you know, it was a way to sort of help care for our world. You know, it was my little contribution to taking care of you know, a larger place than even the Grand Canyon.
Nice.
That was something that I like to leave with them, some thoughts about that sort of thing. I would generally try and read some of the passages that I like, you know, from some of Leopold's books or some of the Sierra Club stuff that I carried with me. Yeah, you know, there's some good thoughts in there. And whether ideologically, you know, you believe all of them or not, you go along with all of them, but you can still take pieces of those thoughts and put together a pretty good perspective for how we should be stewarding and taking care of the world that we live in. And those were some genuine thoughts and some sincere thoughts that I always held, and that I wanted to try and leave with them on the last night.
Nice.
So exiting the canyon, they were exiting the canyon not just as river rats, river runners, a very small minority in the larger scheme of things, really, but they were also exiting the canyon as people that may have learned a different perspective for how they view the environment that they're a part of. So I think in closing, you know, I closed my trips that way. Maybe that's a good way to close our conversation here. But, I still believe all that. I like to go camping up here in the mountains. You know, the mountains up here behind me is where I get most of the wood that I work with. And when I go up to go camping, I still do the same thing. I walk through the camp when I'm getting ready to leave. I make sure I'm picking up all the stuff that might still be lying on the ground that someone else left. Those things are still part of what I do. Maybe they're still part of the, I don't know, 300 to 400 people that I took down the river. Maybe they're part of what they do.
Fun. Very nice. Well, Roger, thank you very much for your time. This has been an interview with Roger Nices and Tom Martin on the 25th of June, 2015. Roger, you can stay on the line. That'd be great.
Okay.